So it's great to be here. First of all, I've never been here before, really enjoying the day here. So I'd like to talk with you a little bit about some of my earlier thesis work, which was on calculating the far infrared spectral energy distributions of embedded protostars, that is, protostars in their earliest class zero phases. So we're thinking about a central source of luminosity that's 4 pi covered by dust, and you're looking at the reprocessed radiation from that, and as well as dust and shrouded galaxies. And this is work that I did at Berkeley with my advisor, Mr. P. So one of the reasons we started doing this is because, you know, there's been a lot of modeling of the dust continuum spectra of low-mass protostars, but not as much of massive protostars. So we wanted to calculate, is there a pointer that I could possibly have? Oh no, it's a laser pointer. Okay.
Well, do we have a
laser? Oh yeah, yeah, I'm no good with these. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Alright, so we wanted to calculate the spectral energy distributions that are predicted by theories of massive star formation, like the turbulent core model that Chris and Jonathan developed a couple of years ago, which is essentially an extension of the low-mass paradigm. I'm going to describe it to you a little bit later. But essentially, you know, we want to use the spectral energy distributions as diagnostic of the large-scale physical conditions in massive cores to get at things like the mass, the size, the luminosity, the density variation in the envelope, and evolutionary parameters like the accretion rate. And in the beginning, we wanted to come up with this for a fairly simple construct. Okay, this, if you have a central source of luminosity, 4 pi covered by dust, we're considering a spherically symmetric geometry. But even this case hasn't been done analytically before. Okay, and we're doing this analytically so that we can address the inversion problem more uniquely, which is that, you know, you're given something in millijanskis. Okay, you're given a spectrum in millijanskis, and from that, you want to get out the source parameters, okay, the mass, size, density variation, etc. Okay, so this is the basic inversion problem of radiative transfer. And one of the things that it could really give us is the mass spectrum of pre-stellar cores in massive star-forming regions. Okay, the thing is, you know, we don't, the formation of massive stars is still a matter of debate. Okay, and if the mass spectrum pre-stellar cores were to resemble the stellar RMF, that would be an argument in favor of the classic accretion picture that you have for low mass star formation. Another thing that I'll talk about towards the end of my talk is, and there's been a lot of debate on this, you know, can you really discriminate between competing theories of star formation, which are characterized by different density variations in the envelope from the phi IR SED of an unresolved source. Some people have said, Osorio et al., Amaya Osorio, Susanna Lozano, and Paula D'Alessio have said that you need a particular kind of density variation in the envelope known as a logotrope, which rho far was like r to the minus 1, to fit the SEDs of massive cores. And I'm actually going to argue that, in general, it is not feasible to infer the density variation in the envelope if you just have the far infrared SED of an unresolved source, okay? Okay, and one of the other, and we also want to apply this methodology to Euler-type systems. And one of our interesting conclusions was that the coal dust that is the far infrared in Euler's can be described by a standard opacity model, like the Weingarten and Grain opacity model, instead of having to invoke grain growth. A lot of people who've done these before find, you know, very shallow opacity indices, which suggests grain growth. And we'd like to use this analytic solution to see if, you know, perhaps sublinear galaxies, which are at higher redshifts, are they analogs of local Euler's? So this is a, you know, an alternate way of doing this, using a self-consistent analytic weighted transfer solution instead of SED templates, which are often built on correlations that are well established at low redshifts, but not so clear how well they extend to high redshifts. And fundamentally, our motivation was to get at the basic physics of radiative transfer for this, first for this very simple case, and then really to use it as a stepping stone for developing solutions for more realistic geometries. And so, for instance, one of the things that I'm working on now that I was telling Lars and Evan during lunch is a generalization to considering a clumpy distribution of dust. Okay. And the basic idea is that, you know, if you punch holes in your medium, you're going to let out more flux at the wavelengths where it was previously optically thick. And our methodology is always, you know, to first develop an analytic solution and to test it in detail by comparing against some numerical scheme. Okay, getting back to this, before I tell you about the details of our solution, just some, you know, advantages and disadvantages of the way we're doing it. Since we're assuming spherical symmetry, our model applies to the earliest stages of protostars, which are known as the class zero stage. And it definitely breaks down, this assumption definitely breaks down in later stages, and numerical schemes have shown that there is significant deviance from the simple solution, particularly the shorter wave ones, as well as clumpy inhomogeneous, if you have a clumpy inhomogeneous medium, that's also going to be a problem for the solution. But the advantages now are that you can classify SEDs for this very large astrophysical parameter space, from low-mass protostars to Euler-type systems. You're spanning a huge range of optical depths in terms of two parameters, and you have functional expressions, actually equations, to solve for these two parameters in terms of observables for a particular density variation in the envelope and some dust opacity curve. And you can, so you can solve for these source parameters, and it also allows you to avoid what I'm going to call the elephant problem. This is just a joke. I'm going to tell you about it a little bit later. And of course, if you have an analytic solution, it's going to be much faster than using a numerical scheme. So what is the elephant problem? Well, it's that, you know, if you add more and more parameters, you can fit just about anything. And in fact, well, what we found is that for SEDs of class zero sources, only two parameters are necessary to describe the SED. In fact, this is something that was known, you know, and we just rediscovered it. anyway, okay, so I just want to give you a little bit of background now on the basic theory of massive star formation here. So we've had this time scale problem, which is that if you want to get at the accretion rates, okay, of massive stars, and if you extrapolate from the standard theories of low mass star formation, which says that the accretion rates are proportional to the isothermal sound speed to the cube, you're going to get formation times that are larger than a million years, which is longer than the main sequence lifetimes of massive stars. Okay. And so what Chris and Jonathan did to address this is they included the non-thermal support in the total signal speed, that is the turbulent support. So they're essentially normalizing to the higher pressures that are observed in regions of massive star formation. Okay, what this means is that you can support denser cores, which, when they go unstable, will have larger accretion rates and allow you to form massive stars more quickly. In their model, the density variation, k rho here, is adopted from observations of clumps. What I mean by clumps here are things on, you know, what I'm going to call a core is something that is going to form a single star or a binary, okay? And a clump is something that has many cores. And in their picture, the clumps and cores are part of the subsolar structure because the cores are also turbulent. And if it's turbulent, it's going to be subsolar down to the thermal Jeans lamp, which finally breaks the subsolarity. But they're not solving for the density variation in their solution. They're adopting the density variation from observations. On the scales of clumps. So in the jargon, if you have a density power law index that is less than 2, so 2 is for the singular isothermal sphere, they're known as these negative index polytropes. What it translates to is that the sound speed increases outwards, which is in fact what is observed. Okay, so you see in their solution that you can form a 100 solar mass star in 10 to the 5th years if it's accreting from a 1 signal of order 1 gram per centimeter squared clump, because you've normalized to the higher pressures, the higher sigmas in these clumps. And there's a slight dependence on the final mass, so what that means is that, you know, low mass stars forming in a high sigma clump will have a somewhat lower accretion rate. There have been, as I said, other alternative proposals, for instance, the coalescence model where you're just colliding stars together to overcome the radiation pressure problem. But this requires fairly large stellar densities and they're typically not observed. Okay, I should say, so that our motivation was to calculate now the SEDs that are predicted by this turbulent core model because it's not been done yet. Okay, so this is the basic picture. You have a central source of luminosity here. UV radiation degrades, travels out through this thick dusty shell and is degraded to longer wavelengths. The spectra typically peak in the infrared. You have some power law density variation within the envelope. Okay? And I will try to use this. Let's see, what do I actually press? Where does it say that? Okay. So I'm gonna, in the rest of my talk, I'm gonna be referring to these two infamous parameters that I mentioned earlier. This parameter RC tilde, okay, which is the ratio of the outer radius to some effective Rosslyn photosphere. Okay, the Rosslyn photosphere is like the tau equals one surface at the peak frequency of the SED. That's where most of the flux is coming from. Okay, and the temperature there is the photosphere temperature. Okay, so you can see if the shell is relatively optically thin, the Rosslyn photosphere is going to be well inwards of the outer radius. Okay, so you'll probe the source function over a large range. Now, let me pump up the density everywhere. I'm going to push the Rosslyn photosphere out. The tau equal to one surface moves further out. I'm not going to see very far into the envelope. And this ratio is correspondingly smaller. Okay? So optically thick shells have a smaller ratio, the smaller ratio RC tilde. Now, our basic picture here, I should say, was to break up the problem into three frequency regimes. So this is a picture of the typical dust continuum spectrum for a massive protostar. So we broke the problem up into three frequency regimes. Low frequencies, standard Rayleigh genes, h mu much less than kT. Intermediate frequencies, h mu is actually of the order of kT, so the temperature matters. And high frequencies, h mu much greater than kT and optical depths much greater than one. Okay. And in addition to so we broke the problem up into these different components, and we solved it in a piecewise manner, and we came up with a joint solution within physical shell model, which I'm going to describe to you in a little bit. The basic idea is that the flux in these different frequency regimes is depicted here, okay? So this is a contribution function. So this is centimeters here on the y-axis. So you see the low frequency comes from the outside because the optically thin flux is proportional to the mass. The intermediate frequencies, okay, h nu is actually of the order of kT, so the temperature matters. So the higher components of the intermediate frequency regime probe deeper and deeper towards the Rosslyn photosphere, okay? So here's the Rosslyn photosphere here at the peak frequency of the SED. So if you look over here, so this is the peak frequency of the SED, okay? Peak frequency of the SED. So this is the tau equal to one surface. So the higher components of the intermediate frequency region probe deeper and deeper into the envelope. In a sense, specified by the temperature variation in the envelope, and the contribution function for the high frequencies will reflect the spectral features in your opacity curve, okay? So here you have your 10 micron, this is your 3 10 to the 13 hertz, this is 10 micron, this is your 10 micron silicate bump here in your rise in your opacity curve, so you're pushed outwards into the envelope. 5 micron decrease and you look further in, okay? So I'd like to now explain to you what this equation means. It's actually quite intuitive, okay? So this says that most of the flux comes from the Rosslyn photosphere, radiating at the photospheric frequency, modulated by dust opacity term, and the different frequency channels, okay, these different frequency channels come from shells that are centered at Rm, okay, a physical location in the envelope Rm, having thickness delta Rm with source function e to the minus h over kT of Rm, that is the temperature there, and attenuated by e to the minus tau as it travels out through the envelope. Okay, so this is our what I'm going to call the shell solution for radio transfer in a spherically symmetric medium. Okay. Now, so it's just an example of how we were doing the integrals. I'm giving up on this little pointer. Too much room. Okay, so this is just, you know, we're integrating the emissivity times the escape fraction over the volume. Okay, so this is your area term here. Okay, this is r to the 2 minus k rho. Okay, you have your r squared dr times rho far, and rho far is going to like r to the minus k rho. Okay, and this thing here, this is just your e to the minus h nu over kt plus tau, and this is your escape fraction, which you need for high frequencies because it's optically thick. But if you look at the structure of this integrand, you'll see that it's an exponential term times an algebraic term. And the argument of the exponential is large, okay? So it's going to dominate its contribution to the integral. So I just need to find where the high frequencies are coming from, and I need to Taylor expand around that. And that's it, okay? So the high frequencies are coming from a location in the shell that's due to the competition between the temperature gradient and the optical depth. Okay, so it's this tug of war between the temperature gradient, which is going to make it come from deeper in, where it's hotter, and the optical depth, which makes it harder to get out. All right? Okay. Now here's the last bit of physics of spherically symmetric radiative transfer, which is that when I talk about a self-consistent radiative transfer solution, it has to satisfy flux conservation. The temperature profile has to satisfy flux conservation. Okay? And so I have a problem because I want to treat this huge parameter space. You know, I'm going from surface densities that are like 0.01 grams per centimeter squared to surface densities that are like, you know, 100 grams per centimeter squared, okay? So the temperature profile is going to vary significantly over this range of optical depths. But I want to make a simplification because as you saw earlier in that picture I showed you for the contribution function, you know, I had the SED on the left and I had the contribution function on the right. You saw that most of the phi IR was coming from outside the Wilson photosphere. So there's very little flux that comes from inside the Wilson photosphere, right? So I can get away with taking an approximation to the actual temperature profile. So here I have a plot of the temperature profile. The solid line here is dusty. Dusty is the code I should have mentioned earlier. It's this numerical scheme that was developed by Moshe Elitzur and his students. It's been very well tested for, it's a code that handles spherically symmetric radiative transfer. So this is the actual numerical solution. The solid line is the numerical solution to the temperature. And the crosses are our adopted temperature profile. And what we have to ensure is that we do get the temperature approximately correct close to the Rossum photosphere and outside it, because that's where most of the far IR comes from. I don't care, it's true I don't hear so well here, but very little flux, it comes from there anyway. Okay, now, so we adopt a single power law for the temperature profile. But of course, the slope of this power law is going to vary over this large parameter space, right? Over this range of optical depths.
Can I understand though, so your source function at high frequency can slip down to an R of 10 to 15? So
the source function for high frequencies.
So 10 to 16 is the Wilson photosphere.
Right.
I thought you had something went down a factor of 10 in radius.
So there for the near IR, right. So we can look back at that. So yeah. So you can see that, you know, the near IR is certainly going to be. I mean, you're talking about this dip here in the 5 micron.
Right.
So it's really true that a lot of the near IR is coming from inside the Wilson photosphere. But what is the contribution of the near IR?
No, I understand.
Right.
If you're near IR observer, you care.
You do, absolutely. But that's why the title of this talk is the far IR. embedded photo stars and dusty galaxies. But it's an excellent point, I think, and I should say that.
I understand though. So is it actually true because the temperature and the Moshe Elitzur stuff is much higher? In which case,
excellent.
The emission from here would be much higher than what you're saying.
Well,
because it's all in the exponential, so you get a much higher temperature.
Yeah. So the temperature is a lot higher in the actual temperature profile is a lot higher, but. So for instance, I'm going to get to that a little bit later. So you can see, you'll see you know, I'll show you the analytic spectrum overplotted with the dusty spectrum, and you can see how it compares at far IR wavelengths, say down to, you know, 20 microns or something. It's very accurate, but of course, in the near IR, it will be a lot lower by about an order of magnitude or something, and we're not, you know, claiming to be accurate there anyway. The point is that, you know, you can get away with it because, in terms of flux conservation, because it contributes so very little to the total flux. Okay, so that's the basic idea behind choosing this single parallel up for the temperature above. Although I do want to say this in a little bit more detail, it's getting a little technical here, but just because we didn't get the temperature there correct, doesn't mean that we can't tell you approximately where the near IR flux comes from, right?
Sure, that's exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so this slope here, I'm going to call now KT in my notation of this K rho KT notation, okay? So now I'm going to tell you how the slope varies, okay? So as you go to very optically thin envelopes, okay, so this is very large RC tilde, okay, you're probing the source function of a large range, right? You can show analytically, it's easy to show that the temperature profile tends to, the slope tends to a third. And as you pump up the density everywhere, the temperature profile is going to have to steepen to transport flux. So we've ensured, you know, by comparison with this numerical scheme, that a radiative transfer solution actually uses a self-consistent temperature profile that guarantees flux conservation. And longwards of 30 microns, okay? Longwards of 30 microns where the opacity is scale-free. It's a parallel. There's nothing to set a scale. There are no spectral features to set a scale. The slope is just a function of this dimensionless parameter. Okay, so this is the question that Lars was asking about. Now, all right, so you see here, this is the solid line, it's the dusty spectrum, and the crosses are the analytic spectrum. So if I were to have pulled this out here, you would have seen that the near IR, you know, you can see that the near IR flux is falling below the predicted numerical value. But we do very well, you know, in the far IR, and typically have accuracies of order, shape accuracy, of order 30% and 1% relative difference in the integrated flux over this parameter space that covers low mass protostar ceilings. So again, I want to, I have this construct of showing the SED on the left, contribution function on the right. So you see here the low frequencies, optically thin flux proportional to the mass. Most of the low frequencies are coming from the outside. Intermediate frequencies probe deeper and deeper into the envelope towards the Rossum photosphere here. Okay, here's the peak frequency of the SED, peak frequency of the SED over here. Okay, in a sense that's specified by the temperature gradient in the envelope, and high frequencies, the contribution function will reflect the spectral features in your opacity curve. Okay, so let's correlate this here. So you've got your 14 micron decrease, you look further in. 10 micron increase, your silicate feature, you're pushed further out. 5 micron decrease, you look further in. Okay, so that's the basic graphical way of understanding spherically symmetric gradient constant. So what is this bias? Well, essentially, now we have an equation, okay, for the flux, for the emergent flux. Within this, certainly within this approximate development, where if I'm given three colors, okay, I can solve, or sorry, three fluxes, two colors, okay, I can solve for these two parameters, for a given density variation in the envelope and some opacity curve. And longwards of 30 microns, the shape of the SED, okay, not the normalization, but just the shape, is just going to depend on this one parameter, because longwards of 30 microns, there's nothing to set a scale in the opacity curve, okay? And the photospheric temperature is just going to shift the peak of the SED, okay? So I'm not writing down the equations anymore, but just trust me, you know, you now have an analytic solution between the source parameters that you want to infer, okay, which are the luminosity over mass and surface density, okay, from the observed fluxes. Okay, from the observed fluxes, you solve for the SED variables, okay, which govern the shape of the SED. And then you can immediately solve for the source parameters. Okay? And if you further have a distance measurement, okay, you know how far it is, then you can solve for the size of the source itself.
The 3-millimeter flux, is the whole thing optically thin at 3 millimeters?
Yeah, well, generally it is, yeah.
So then you'd also have that emissivity exponent that you'd have to pick, right?
So, correct. So again, so the point is that, so this is for a given density variation in the envelope and a given opacity curve, right? Yeah, yeah. So for that, you will have two unknown things, and we have equations for those two unknown things. So we can't, so if you, of course, you can just determine beta if you just had enough measurements there, but if you didn't, then you would have to calculate it for a given opacity curve.
Okay. I'm actually really curious, though, because it's actually amazing how, so at the really low frequency, all right, where traditionally you have a black line, you always thought it would be a gene ball, it's like mu squared. In your case, you have it going like mu cubed, is that correct? Is there a way to understand why that's true?
No. You'll see that if you actually expand out the exponential, you'll see that it actually gets like mu squared.
Yeah, but that's usually because it's exponent to minus, exponent minus 1, and then that 1 cancels out the 1.
No, for this case also, if it's actually low frequencies, if h nu over kt is much less than 1,
right,
it will go as mu squared. But if you have the intermediate frequencies, which have a flatter slope, then basically what happens is that you can't expand the exponential anymore, right? So that's what leads you to having a flatter slope. But no, the Rayleigh James is still has a mu squared slope, but there's some transition region between, the Rayleigh James and what I'm calling, which I'm calling the low frequencies, and the intermediate frequencies, which do depend on the temperature.
But again, there's not really a Rayleigh James because it's also going optically thin in that region, the low frequencies, like in the millimeter range.
Uh-huh.
So it's the Rayleigh James times the emissivity, which is more like mu cubed or mu to the fourth.
Oh, right. No, yeah. Okay, so the flux. So the flux is going to go like mu to the fourth.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, the flux is going to go like mu to the fourth. Okay, I thought you were, the flux is just going to go like mu squared times kappa mu, right? So if you're, okay. Okay, so here I'm just showing the physical parameter space, luminosity over mass versus surface density, and I've showing you where various sources appear. So low mass stars at low surface densities and dwarfs and superstar clusters at higher surface densities. And I've overlaid lines of constant RC tilde. Okay, so you can see that high surface densities have low RC tilde. You don't see very far into the envelope. And as you go to low surface densities, you are seeing very far into the envelope. And these are two characteristic spectra of low RC tilde envelopes. You're tending to the modified black body limits and large RC tilde envelopes, which have a much broader spectrum. And you can sort of start to see the intermediate frequency components separate out. So I'd like to show you a limiting case where it does separate out. Okay, and this is a conceptually important case, and there's a small region of astrophysical parameter space where this is actually important. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to let the outer radius of the shell go to infinity. Okay, so RC tilde now is very large. You have this huge extended optically thin region. So the temperatures there are very low, right? And even at 1 millimeter, okay, because h nu over kt, because t is so small, it's really, it's not really in the Rayleigh James limit, because h nu is actually of the order of kt, and you see the intermediate frequency region separate out, which has a shallower slope. And in this case, you can write down an expression for the slope. I'm using, for the dust opacity index here, I'm using p. So you have your density variation in the envelope, and now the temperature profile in this limit has gone to constant. Okay? So in this limit, where the, so the astrophysical part of the, you know, the place where you would see stuff like this are for nearly pre-stellar cores. Okay, nearly pre-stellar cores, very low luminosity cores, which are in regions of very low surface density. So RC Tolga is very large, and you'll see this, you know, you should be able, if you have enough sub-millimeter measurements, okay, you'll be able to analytically solve for the density variation in the envelope. But as I'll show later, over most of the parameter space, you cannot. Okay, so this load...
What actually sets the dust temperature out there is you get this large diffuse region. What actually sets the dust temperature out?
So, radiant of equilibrium.
Based on the infrared from this, from the peak of this flux.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so your so this slope is, perhaps I wasn't quite answering your question earlier, I think I was, but so this intermediate frequency slope is flatter than your Rayleigh-Jean slope, and this is what goes as mu cubed. So when you said mu cubed, that immediately jumped to intermediate frequencies, and your Rayleigh-Jean flux goes as mu to the fourth, but this is a 1 power flatter for a particular density variation. It actually depends on the density variation in your envelope. Okay, so we applied our methodology to get out the source parameters of some well-known massive protostars, and we found accretion rates. So we first, you solve for these source parameters, and then within the construct of some, you know, evolutionary model, like say, you know, in this case, Chris and Jonathan's model, okay, we solve for the accretion rates, and we found a good agreement with their predicted accretion rates. And we also tested it by doing this for low and intermediate mass protostars that have been much better studied, and we generally found good agreement with prior work. So I'll just wrap up this section by talking about a point that I mentioned earlier, which is that can you really determine the density variation in the envelope if all you have is the FAR-IR SED of an unresolved source? People have, before this, said that there is, you know, a best fit density variation, okay? And some people have said that you must have a particular density variation to model the dust continuum emission from massive cores. Okay, so here I'm showing you the colors here for different sigma sources, okay? So these three have sigma of order 0.01, so very low sigma, and you see how the colors disperse for these three density variations. And they're much more clustered together for this relatively high sigma source. Okay, so now let me show you the SEDs. Okay, so they have the same surface density, okay? These three SEDs have the same surface density, but different density variations. And you see that the far IR is nearly the same, okay? And again, I'm overlaying here 30% error bars to give you a sense of the difference. Okay, and you can see that you couldn't, from the far infrared SED, you could not discriminate the density variation of the envelope if you're in a region of even moderate surface density. You could, in that case where I showed you earlier, when the intermediate frequency component separates out, and you can actually analytically solve for the density variation from, if you have enough measurements on the submillimeter end of your spectrum. So I'm starting to, I will be working with Eileen Van Gisselwick, who does have a lot of submillimeter observations.
How do you normalize those three spectrum? Yeah.
I just...
Oh,
yeah. I just take some okay, so I just want to hone in this point one more time, okay? So I'm taking a particular point on the L over M, luminosity over mass versus surface density, okay? And I showed you the spectra earlier for three different envelopes that have the same luminosity over mass and the same surface density, so a particular point here. Okay, but see, really, this is a plane, but you really have a density profile axis coming out of the page, okay? But as you go to high surface density, okay, it's like you're squashing that third dimension. It's like, you know, it's like you're stepping on a box and squashing the third dimension, the information that you can get about the density variation. You're concealing that. But as you're going to larger RC tilde, the box flares out. And the basic intuition behind that is just that you're probing the source function now over a very extended range. And so these are revealing envelopes, okay? So it's like you've stepped on the box. Okay. All right. And so as I said, you know, we also tried to apply our methodology to Euler type systems, and in a very cartoonish way in this first sort of crack at it. So here I have two pictures here. One, our solutions really apply more to this case when you have a central source of luminosity, right? As opposed to if you have an extended source of luminosity, like an extended starburst with a lot of emission outside some effect over awesome photosphere. This is something that I'll be treating very soon before I may be allowed to submit my thesis, but I haven't done it yet. Okay. So what we found is that the coal dust in Euler's, and this is RT20 over here, I'll tell you in a moment why there's this blue thing. But the far IR, what we found is the if you use a self-consistent temperature profile, okay, which we have, remember now, from our solutions, okay, where a KT of RC tilde here is your temperature gradient within the envelope, you can fit the SEDs of Euler's even if you have a standard of passing model, like the Weingartner and Drayton passing model. On the other hand, if you use a single temperature modified black body, which means that all of the emission is characterized by one temperature, then you will have to use a very shallow opacity index, which suggests grain growth. But in fact, you know, we find that the dust in a varying environments of Euler's can be well described by this standard opacity model if you have a self-consistent solution. So why did I have this blue thing here? It's because I don't do so well, and so I've had to, conceal it from the, I've had to conceal the shame of our solution at short wavelengths. But that's why we're, because these things are, they're not homogeneous. So there's a lot of excess flux, particularly at the shorter wavelengths. So we're generalizing our solutions now to deal with that as well.
Well, let's go back to where are the points in terms of this whole new afternoon? So we integrate that.
So
20% of the flux, right?
No, I agree. But see, the thing is that this is not, these really just don't fall very well into this our simple construct. If you obey a spherical geometry, homogeneous
You had this huge opacity peak. Where is that in the frequency space? The 10 micron? I can't do
a huge. So 3 to the 13 is 10 microns, opacity peak. So this is the silicon absorption.
That's where in the frequency.
Yeah. So Euler's have been modeled in detail. A lot of people.
But there's no evidence for that in this data, or all your models had a very big data range, right?
So,
for certain frequencies,
but you can see, this is consistent with that actually. The problem is that, this is where the spectrum is falling.
Right.
Very steeply. So this is your 10 micron.
I see.
Okay. That's but the problem is that we can't recover the emitted flux here because we haven't, taken into account the fact that the 20 micron, for instance, there might be lines of sight that are oscillating, and we've considered it as a homogeneous source. So, and moreover, these are not spherically symmetric. Okay, they have some inclination. You may be having preferential line of sight. So this is really a very
And what this reminds me of is that I think that considering Euler's as a single class is a really a mistake.
Oh, yeah.
Because some have AGN spectra, some have starburst spectra.
Absolutely.
And the ones with AGN spectra are a lot warmer.
Yeah.
In general. Mm-hmm. So for this you might want to stick to those Euler's which have starburst spectra.
But the starburst spectra, we would have the problem that if the far IR is dominated by a lot of, an extended source of luminosity, that's not what we really considered. What we can do.
They're mostly nuclear starbursts, like our 220 is quite compact.
Okay,
but,
right.
So in an AGN case, there's, of course, a lot of very hot dust all the way up to the sublimation temperature. And some of the, as I say, some of the ELIRCs have H2-read spectrum. Some have, right. Some are hidden quasars and right. Some are starbursts.
Right.
And they behave qualitatively differently.
Oh, absolutely. The spectra are.
So what you might do, just for it to be well defined more than anything else, mm-hmm. is restrict your ELIRCs to the starburst ones. Or depending on what you're modeling. But I think if you mix the starburst and the AGN ones, you'll end up with something that's unphysical.
I definitely agree with the general point. So for the AGN, if a lot of, you know, if it's heavily extincted, and I don't quite see why you would why it would be a problem. You know, if the emission from some effective dust destruction radius is heavily obscured, so there's...
If the opacity to the near and mid-IR is infinite, then, of course, you don't get much radiation there from the AGN.
Right, right.
In practice, the AGNs are considerably warmer than...
Right, but that's because of clumping, isn't it? Isn't it because the dust is distributed in clumps? And so there are some lines of sight that are...
It's possible, but I mean, if you get like in a sieve or two, it's just mm-hmm. like the ELIRC,
right,
the AGN,
right.
And certainly, even if you modeled the dust region, the toroidal region, in a smooth manner, you
yeah.
still get a hot emission mm-hmm. compared to the starburst, unless you were precisely in the equatorial plane.
Okay, so you're saying that's because of the inclination.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good evidence
yeah.
that it is.
Absolutely. No. So we've neglected a number of things, right? We've neglected the fact
yeah, that... Yeah, I'm not yeah. saying put more things in. I'm just saying that
yeah.
when we plot data, I'm just saying that when we plot data,
right.
it would be harder to, it's harder to understand if you mix in the AGN like ELIRCs and the others.
Okay.
So I yeah. think people should say ELIRC because that's not well defined.
No, I agree. This is a huge... problem for me because my background is in star formation. So when I started to work on this, it was very confusing.
Yeah, and a third of them are liners, and those
yeah.
are another story.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let me just wrap up this part of the talk. So from two color ratios, we're solving for the SED variables, RC tilde and the photospheric temperature. And we get the entire millimeter to far infrared spectral energy distribution, which, along with the 30 microns radio opacity scale, 3 is just a function of one parameter. And so we can now have an analytic translation between the observed quantities and the source parameters that we'd like to infer. And then, once we have those, within the context of some evolutionary model, say, like, for instance, the turbulent core model that Chris and John have developed, we can get the accretion rates. And we saw that, you know, for optically relatively high, even moderate surface density envelopes, it's very difficult to determine the density variation in the envelope. There's a small region of astrophysical primer space. For pre-stellar cores or very low luminosity cores, you can do it, but in general, over most of the primer space, you can't. And the cold dust ELIRCs, might be described by a single thing. And this is very preliminary now, but I would like to, I'm starting to think about having the dust distributed in clumps, okay? But I want to do first the simple case, which is if you have a large covering factor, so there are many clumps randomly distributed, and there are not very many unobscured lines of sight to the central source. In this case, you know, it seems that you might be able to approximate the temperature variation as that what we had from the homogeneous case. In general, of course, you can't, okay? Because if, for instance, you know, if your covering factor is small, you have two clumps here, okay? The emission from this one is gonna heat this side, this face of the clump, and this face is gonna be dark. Okay, we're not doing that case, because that's complicated. Some people have dealt with it previously numerically. But essentially what this does, if you have a large covering factor, it modifies the effective absorption coefficient, right? Which just which is something that was worked out by Bauer and Field in 1969. So I'm just going to take their solution and see if I take the temperature variation that I have before and this modified effective optical depth, which means that, you know, at the frequencies where it was previously optically thick, it's going to let out more flux. How well do I do? And there will be a range of covering factor for which this will work. But it's not a general solution. Okay, so, and now going on to even more speculative stuff. I'm working right now with Hendrik Beuter of the SMA to get at an accurate mass spectrum of massive stellar cores using our radiative transfer solution. As I said, you know, now people are starting to get observations now on the scales of massive cores, like on the scales of thousands of AUs rather than on the scales of, you know, 0.1 parsec. So if we find that, there was this paper written by Mott and Andre where they showed that the mass spectrum of pre-stellar cores in a low mass star forming region resembles the stellar IMF. And if we were to find that in this case, that would be an argument for this classic accretion picture. And of course, I'd like to generalize to an extended source of luminosity as well, not just considering a single source of luminosity, but many distributed sources of luminosity. So in this case, I think what matters is the ratio of the relative separation between the sources to an effective Rossum photosphere. Okay, so I'm going to define this L tilde parameter, okay, where L tilde is the ratio of the separation to an effective Rossum photosphere. So you can see that when this ratio is large, they're well separated, then the temperature in the ambient medium is just going to be the sum of the temperatures. Okay, the temperature is going to satisfy superposition. When L tilde is much less than 1, it's just like you have a homogeneous distribution of sources. When L tilde is of order 1, then I have to do it numerically and come up with some kind of fitting procedure. And the other thing that I'd like to do is to try to see if I can do 2D radio transfer analytically. This may not actually work at all, but it would if it were to work, we could actually quantify the effects of clumping versus embedded disks that are well inside an effective Rossum photosphere. The reason I want to do this is because people now have been getting, the reason I want to do the 2D stuff is because people have been getting observations on the scales of massive cores. So this is a dust continuum image and the contours are H13CN. And, you know, in Chris and Jonathan's picture, they have the spherical model because the observations on the scales of clumps actually, you know, they were on average fairly spherical. But now, on the scales of cores, you can see that they're, you know, the aspect ratios are roughly 3-1, so these are highly flattened systems. So, when people have estimated the 2-ray Q of these quote-unquote disks, it's not actually clear, they're entirely rotationally supported, they found the 2-ray Q values are less than 1, which would mean that they're extremely unstable. But they've used this, again, the single temperature approximation, so if you actually get the mass and temperature from a radiative transfer solution, you might have a better estimate of these 2-ray Q values. And then it would be important to see if clumps and cores are really part of a self-similar structure. Because if they were, you wouldn't expect any relative difference in the aspect ratios. Okay. So, and the other thing that I'd like to do is to sort of go back to some of the work that I did earlier with a couple of years ago with Frank and Greg Laughlin on looking at the response of a gas disk when it's perturbed by a spiral perturbation. And we found the generation of these, what have been called spiral substructure, these branches that have a long azimuthal winding and spurs, leading features that wind in the opposite sense to the main spiral arms. We were doing this for galactic disks, and it might be that, and this is a completely, I'm just guessing at the time, I just saw this image, I thought it was really stunning. This is a super image of spiral substructure in a protostellar disk, and it's just one of the really, one of the most stunning features I've seen here. So you see, you know, this the substructure, the spurs and branches and feathers projecting out. And it may be that it's globally unstable, or it could be due to a driven response, type C. Anyway, thank you for your attention.